They are not trying to be part of the American way of life. They are not trying to be part of our culture. They are here with an agenda to make Islam the law of the land. Of course, not all Muslims are like that. But
of course not.
We've been infiltrated with this kind of agenda. And America has to wake up, because we are strangling ourselves with our political correctness.
What's going on?
What's going on, Radio Jihadists? Good evening. You're back with ACT Radio Jihad, the patriotic resistance movement. I'm Vito Esposito. Mama Mia, no Sharia. Our call-in number today
area
is...
Area code 347-857-1380. Radio Jihad.
That's a cool song. I love that thing. I'm joined by a new pork-eating American lover, Alan. Alan, how you doing?
Assalamu alaikum, my brother.
Salami and cheese to you, my brother. Well, it seems like the religion of peace is at it again, ladies and gentlemen. Seven Islamists arrested in Birmingham, England. Six men and one woman. They ranged in age from 22 to 32. Al, they fit that profile. Muslim men, usually, between the ages of 18 and 35. Let's see. Seven Islamists arrested in Birmingham for terror plot. Ages range from 22 to 32, plus there was one woman, age 22, who was arrested. She's being held for failing to disclose information that could prevent an act of terrorism. Mama mia, no Sharia. They fit the profile. Oh, I almost said the word. I almost said that P word. British police arrested a group of suspected Islamic extremists on Monday in one of the most significant counter-terror operations of the year. Officers were also carrying out raids on several homes and a commercial property in the central city of Birmingham as part of the intelligence-led operation. Although the plot was in its early stages and targets weren't immediately known, British security officials said the threat appeared significant and involved Islamic extremists. How about just saying fundamental Islamics? But you know what, Al? At least they identified the enemy. They identified who the culprits were that were engaged in a terror plot. This morning, all across the news media, seven people arrested, six men and one woman arrested in Birmingham, seven persons arrested in Birmingham, England, for hatching a terror plot, seven people arrested, six men and one woman arrested in terror plot in Birmingham, England. And I'm watching this. So then I decided to go to the computer and say, okay, I put in seven arrested. I put seven people arrested in my Google search. Terror plot, Birmingham, England. It pops up. Seven suspected Islamic terrorists were arrested. Islamic extremists were arrested. I'm going, I just watched the news for an hour and a half. Not one word, not one mention that it was a Muslim. Not one mentioned the word Islam. It took going to the print media to identify who the enemy is. They were males, predominantly, six out of seven. That's a majority. Predominantly males ages 18 to 35. That's exactly what the profile says. Males, age 18 to 35. Six males, ages 22 to 32. Mama mia, no Sharia. It's just incredible. Six men were arrested overnight and were being held under anti-terror legislation. A woman was also arrested Monday morning for failing to disclose information. The suspects are aged between 22 and 32, all were described as British residents, and police would not give any details about the nationality or ethnicity. The threat level remains substantial Monday. As more details emerge of this plot, the threat level may be reassessed, according to British government officials who spoke on the condition of anonymity. They've got an anonymity there, too. I only thought they had him in America because of the sensitivity of his work and the ongoing investigation. Britain lowered its assessment of terror attack from severe to substantial in July. The current threat level remains means risk of an attack are strong possibilities. Incredible. Absolutely incredible. You have a situation in the UK, they're being overrun by Islamists. They're being overrun by Muslims who are wanting to take over the United Kingdom. And the press in America can't even mention that seven Islamists were arrested in a planned terror plot to do some damage, to do something in the UK.
Well, Vito, how are we supposed to defeat an enemy if we refuse to identify them?
We don't. We're going to embrace them, Al. We're going to embrace them. We're going to sit around and we're just going to... Oh, there we go. Kumbaya. Let's not identify the enemy. Kumbaya. Stick your head in the sand. Kumbaya. You know, you're exactly right. How are you supposed to defeat the enemy if you cannot identify them? That goes for the United States, the United Kingdom. It goes for all of Europe. The enemy is Islam. The enemy is hiding under the banner of Islam. You know, I kind of get chills when I think about the remarks by Sheikh Obama. Civilization's debt to Islam. What debt do we owe to Islam? Islam has contributed a lot to the United States. Really? What did they contribute to America? The first bombing in 1993, World Trade Center? Was it maybe the attack on the Pentagon, September 11, 2001? Or maybe it was taking down the World Trade Center complex and killing 3,000 people in New York City September 11, 2001. Can you think of any other contributions that Islam has brought to America except fear and intimidation?
Well, let's see. The Islamists have brought hundreds upon hundreds of charities here to the United States, which they're raising money for jihad, so that may not be such a good thing either. Hmm.
Well, do you think maybe Gotti can think of something?
Oh, my Gotti.
Well, I got a whole bunch of things they brought us.
Good
I
morning,
mean,
Gotti.
Would,
how are you?
Where would Dearborn, Michigan be if not for the Arab Festival? Alan, you've been there. You can tell us about that. That's a beautiful, wonderful carnival-type atmosphere.
Oh, it's a zoo. It's an upcoming, growing no-go zone. It's an emerging no-go zone within the United States of America.
Yes, but let's not call it a zoo because no zoo would be complete without pigs, and there's no pork allowed at the Dearborn Festival.
But the falafel sandwiches are awesome, I have to admit.
Oh, I'm sure they are. But I don't want to tell you what they put inside your falafel if they saw you come. Now, there's a good sound effect.
I have goats. I want your teenage son. Kumbaya. Hodra says kumbaya in Arabic.
In your pocket.
What's that?
Oh, Lord. So how are you, fellows?
We are doing fine. We're just discussing about the seven people who were arrested in Birmingham, England, on account of terror plots in the United Kingdom. And it took, I listened to the news this morning for an hour and a half, and never once did they describe the attempted attackers, the attempted bombers, as being Islamic.
Yeah, well, they're not gonna. We're not at war with Islam. What's the matter with you, Vito? Didn't you read my last article?
I did, but I have a learning disability. I apologize.
We are not at war with Islam, nor are we at war with Muslims, nor are we at war, get this, with terrorists, because terror is just an ideology. We are at war with Al-Qaeda, and only Al-Qaeda. Gee, I sure hope all the homegrown terrorists in this country get that memo.
What about on May 14th, 2011, when FBI agents arrested Hafiz Khan and his sons Itzar and Ifra Khan, the daughter Amina Khan, and the grandson Alam Zeb down in South Florida? Their charges were providing material support to a conspiracy to kill, injure, kidnap people abroad, and sending $50,000 to the Pakistani Taliban. Now, this is and this imam is the Western equivalent of a priest, pastor, or rabbi, a spiritual leader of the community, a man well-versed in Sharia and theocratic-compliant Islam. And yet here he is, a terrorist, and bringing his family on board all the way down to his grandson. Who knows how many people within his mosque that he influenced with this type of political thought.
You could probably add Genghis Khan and Madeline Khan to that as well.
Our government would have you believe that given the fact that he had associations with the Pakistani Taliban, therefore indirectly an association if the Taliban were involved with Al-Qaeda, and therefore he is part of the Al-Qaeda group, and therefore we are at war with Al-Qaeda. Don't you see? Everything links back to Al-Qaeda. If you read my last article, you'd know that, because this is all according to Hillary Clinton now.
Yeah, she gives such tremendous speeches, doesn't she? She is just
wonderful. Yes.
She's the gift that just keeps on giving.
The ideology that fueled Bin Laden. You know, it's the Bin Laden ideology, which, as I corrected her, Madam Secretary, in my article, since he was born in 1957, that so-called ideology that she was referring to, terrorism, was around long before he was even born. And maybe it's the ideology of, Islam?
Yeah, but now don't you see, this is a whole created propaganda tool by the Obama administration, really, to allow Americans to make Americans accept Islam as just another religion, and that they're here because they're a little bit different than, let's say, Christianity or Judaism. They're still one and the same, and they should be able to conduct their religious ceremonies as they see fit. So what better way to disarm the American people than to have someone like Hillary Clinton sanitize Islam and allow for America to drop their guard? In the meantime, we know what Islam has contributed to the Clintons, to the tune of, over $25 million. We know that Sheikh Obama is beholden to the king of Saudi Arabia, and the fact that Sheikh Obama stated in June 4, 2009, that America is no longer a Christian nation, that just continues to help sanitize Islam for what it really is, a totalitarian ideology that despises democracy, despises man-made law, and despises the United States of America because we fit those other two patterns.
Well, I'd hate to say it, you know, but using your words, there ain't enough Lysol or bleach in the world to sanitize Islam. So, you know, be that for what it may, they're using Al-Qaeda as the scapegoat, saying that it's perverted what this religion of peace really is. But all one has to do is look at history. Long before Al-Qaeda existed, there were attacks on American citizens. Long before Al-Qaeda existed, there were attacks on American servicemen. All you have to do is go back to 1983 to the Marine Corps barracks in Lebanon. Whoa, was that Al-Qaeda? No, it wasn't. Al-Qaeda didn't exist. So what was that? Oh, that's right. It was Islamic terrorism.
Yeah, you know, Gotti, you can also just go back to their own book, that thing that they call the Quran, as Osama rightly translated, it's the generous Quran. It's not even called the Holy Quran because there's nothing holy about it. But when you just pick up and you read chapter 9, verse 73, "Oh, you prophet, perform jihad against the infidels and the hypocrites and be harsh with them." Well, if Americans would just take the time to read this thing called the Quran, they'd realize that infidels means you and I. That means non-Muslims. hypocrites are those that basically leave Islam or profess to be Islamic, but it's okay to kill them if they do not hold to what Allah says. So engage in war with the infidels and be harsh on them. And that's exactly what Islam is doing today.
As you and I both know, that every single bleeding heart, kumbaya loving liberal in this country will be the first one to tell you, but oh, if you look at the Old Testament and even parts of the New Testament, you're going to find writings just like that too. They were killing people right and left in the name of God. So you can't believe that. That's just their holy book.
Yeah, and it's usually the Muslims that are like to bring up the Old Testament. And the issue is that Americans have, or Christians have evolved over the last 2,000 years, whereas Islam has not over the last 1,400 years. It has not evolved. And, you know, we can look forward to the New Testament, and we can follow the teachings of Jesus Christ, and we can move forward, and we can be better people. Living in a desert and in a cave is not being a better person when you're following a 53-year-old man who marries a 6-year-old, practices dying, engages in dying when she's 6 to age 9, and then rapes her at age 9, and then you call him the greatest man. Then you call him the purest of man. How can this type of person be pure when, in fact, he rapes a 9-year-old or engages the Quraishi tribe who gives themselves up and then proceeds to commit genocide against the tribe and then take the women and children into his concubines?
Peace-loving, wasn't
he? Did we miss something in that? I mean, do we not get the memo on that one or what?
Well, let's explore the foundation of that, because you bring up a great point. A lot of people don't know the foundation of Islam and who Muhammad is. Now, Islam is a totalitarian supremacist ideology. So, where it comes from is that Muhammad, Allah, spoke to the angel Gabriel, transmitted the Quran to Allah. The Quran, how a Muslim believes, is not corrupted by man. It is straight from Allah, which makes it superior to every other religious text, whether it be the Old Testament, the New Testament, the Torah, even our Constitution of the United States of America. And it is a superior ideology. Therefore, they believe that their way of thinking is superior to everybody else on earth because their message comes straight from Allah himself.
Well, Al,
let's
not go by a day so that they can also put this in context what you said. When Omar Ahmad, the co-founder of the Council on American Islamic Relations, says that Islam is not in America to be equal but to become dominant, the Quran, the Muslim book of scripture, should be the highest authority in America, and Islam, the only accepted religion on earth, doesn't that sound like it may be a bit seditious in your opinion? And for what you just said, can it coexist? Because that's the new buzzword in the world. Can it coexist with man-made law called the U.S. Constitution?
Well, no, and it couldn't from 1,400 years ago, because when you have a supremacist totalitarian ideology with a religious bent that it is divinely inspired, Allah's laws versus man's law, or God's law versus man's law will always come up second best. Therefore, the Muslim believes that their viewpoints, as I said before, are superior. And that quote from Omar Ahmed, he gets it. He understands his Islam. He should be commended for that because he's practicing the true Islam. It should shock nobody, yet it does, because our liberals and liberal socialists believe in, like you said, coexistence. And what is coexistence? That's respect for your other faiths.
I get warm and fuzzy when I see those bumper stickers that coexist, and it's got all the religious symbols on it, and it's like, oh, we have another one that's drinking the Kool-Aid that's been duped about coexisting. All right, so you have the issue of Mo, who at age 53 marries a 6-year-old from his what his most trusted friend, wasn't it Abu Bakr?
Yes.
And he ends up marrying her at 6, engages in the art of dying, and Muslims know what that is.
Yeah.
And then consummates the marriage when she's age 9, which in effect amounts to rape. And then during that, he was said to engage in 67 kill missions. So I don't recall one kill mission that that Christ had involved himself in.
No. And a little-known fact, too, is that Aisha, the 6-year-old girl you're talking about, had an older sister at the time, yet Muhammad had his eyes on Aisha, the younger sister. So he could have taken Abu Bakr's oldest daughter, but he liked the younger one. That's a pathological sickness.
Well,
I don't care what date and time. I don't care. Yeah. I don't care when you lived, whether it's 1,400 years ago or 5,000. A 53-year-old man having sexual relations with a child is wrong.
Damn, you beat me to the punch.
Oops, sorry.
I was going to say that you were told that that girls matured faster in the desert back then.
We were told that.
And that was the justification.
We were told that with a straight face by Basim Chaban, the outreach director of the Islamic Society of Central Florida, at a public interfaith dialogue. He had the chutzpah to say that.
It's difficult to comprehend. You want to take a call?
Yeah, let's put them on.
All right, 415. Welcome to Radio Jihad. Keep it clean.
Hi, my name is Rade Akarna. I'm from the Bay Area.
Okay.
Now, I heard you mention a number of things. Now, don't be alarmed. I'm not Muslim.
Okay.
But when you go into the Bible, when it comes down to what it is the Muslims are actually trying to follow, they're trying to duplicate their own priesthood like the Levites had in the Old Testament. Now, they actually rose to power. They are the Ishmaelites, but when you look at who they are in the world today...
Wait, who's they? Who's they?
The Muslims.
Okay, so the Muslims wrote the Bible?
No, that's not what I said at all.
Okay.
All right,
we're just trying to follow you. Set up your point with a little bit of enough background so we know exactly where you're going.
Okay, all right. So, traditionally speaking, the closest neighbors to the Israelites in the Old Testament were the tribes of Ishmael and the tribes of Esau and the tribes of Canaan. Now, when you go into Deuteronomy, the 28th chapter, verses 15 through 68, it gives you a pretty lengthy prophecy in terms of what will happen to the children of Israel for their in terms of curses for disobedience. And so when that happened, I think 70 A.D. with the fall of Jerusalem was when those curses actually started befalling them. And within that time, after the children of Israel had fallen, then came the Ishmaelites, then came the Edomites, and yes, they did come with this religion called Islam. So what they did was, playing off of old ancient word terminology, Allah is actually, it's simply just a word that means the God. But they're not even using the full title. Allah was simply part of the ancient title. You might know it as Elohim. It's actually in the ancient Paleo Hebrews pronounced Allahayim. And so really they're just working with like a really small fragment. The Quran really is more or less just I consider it a plagiarized book, really, honestly speaking. And it's considerably shorter than the Bible. Now, the thing is that the clans of Ishmael, if when you look into the Old Testament, it tells you that they will receive blessings as well. We're looking at that blessing now. This is it. This is coming to the end of that blessing. And also, it was the same thing with the Ishmaelites. I mean, not the Ishmaelites, the Edomites.
Mm-hmm.
We're looking at their blessings as well in the world today. And
what's your point?
My point is that neither the Jewish people who are over there in the land right now, or the Muslims, have anything to do with the people of the Bible. The people of the Bible have been obscured by way of what? Deuteronomy 28. Yes, they have been obscured completely. I can prove it. Would you like me to get the script?
Your show, Vito.
Hey, well, I'll tell you what. Just do it and give me 60 seconds. Go ahead.
Okay. All right. And here it is. It says, this is Deuteronomy 28 and 64. And the Lord shall scatter thee among all people from the one end of the earth even unto the other. And there thou shalt serve other gods, which neither thou nor thy fathers have known, even wood and stone. And among these nations thou shalt find no ease, neither shall the sole of thy foot have rest. But the Lord shall give thee there a trembling heart, a failing of eyes, and a sorrow of mind. And thy life shall hang in doubt before thee, and thou shalt fear day and night, and thou shalt have none assurance of thy life.
Okay.
Then it says here, verse 68, and the Lord shall bring thee into Egypt again with ships. By the way whereof I spake unto thee, thou shalt see it no more again, and there ye shall be sold unto your enemies for bondmen,
okay,
bondwomen,
right,
and no man,
sir,
shall buy you.
All right, okay,
yeah,
you're so deep in the weeds right now, my head does have no clue what you just said. Can you put that into simple English?
Well, that was English, so I'll rephrase it. In other words, they were scattered by way of cargo slave ships from one end of the earth to the other end of the earth. And when we, the only prophecy that really fulfills that is what we will call the, both the Trans-Saharan and the Transatlantic slave trades. That's it. You know, that's the only prophecy that's a,
yeah,
that
but
can,
the Islamists,
that fulfill that prophecy.
Oh, hold on. Hold on there. The Islamists actually, they procured the slaves for,
yes, they did,
for the white man.
Yes, they did. That's
what
the other half of this I'm bringing out. So when it was during that period of time that they were, these were primarily the ones working on obscuring this history. You get what I'm saying? So they built up
Whose history?
The history of the real Israelites. They wanted to usurp it the entire time. That's
oh, the black. Oh, the black Israelites. You mean?
They're all black, all of them.
Oh, okay. All right.
Yeah, and I could also go into the scripture and prove that if even they did
I'm
mix
not arguing
another
with
group.
You.
All right. Well, I'm not trying to argue. I'm saying if
what's your belief structure?
With another
so
group,
I know where you're coming from.
It would be considered Mainzers and would not be considered Israelites any longer.
Okay.
Hold on a second, Radia. Hold on a second.
In relation,
Radia. Hold on.
Go ahead.
Whoa. Go ahead, Al. Go ahead.
What is your belief structure so I know where you're coming from? Are you Christian?
I'm coming from the Bible.
Muslim? Are you black nationalists? What are you?
None of them. I'm coming from the Bible.
Okay, so you're a Christian guy.
None of them. There is no term for what I am and for what my beliefs are. There's no real terminology for it. So all I can really tell you about me is I pick up the Bible and read, and I'm able to look at what's going on in the world. And I'm able to match up according to history and according to politics where things fall into place with actual biblical policy. I mean, prophecy. What I don't do is I don't follow theology. You get what
I
mean?
Okay. I hear you. I agree. All right. Well, was that your main point you wanted to get across?
Perfect.
Well, I mean, I was really just trying to add to what you were saying to a certain extent, but also shed some real light in terms of their in-depth motives behind what's going on and what this battle going on over there in Palestine really actually means in terms of
biblical.
There's
no such thing as Palestine.
It don't matter. That area of the world, that portion of the world, be it
right,
Palestine,
so it's
be it Jordan.
We get it. Yeah.
All right, so what you're actually looking at, If you wanted to look into a scripture about it, I don't know if you guys are atheists or what, but if you wanted to go into a scripture about it, you should look into Joel chapter 3, and that will explain exactly what's going on. This is the part where God says, "Gather around me, heathen, round about."
Yeah,
I will then judge.
Yeah, we're more of a current event show rather than getting into biblical prophecy, although it is extremely important in the bigger picture.
Yes.
So, do you got any current events that's on the top of your head? Because mine's about
No. I just wanted to add to what you were saying. That's all.
Okay.
All right. But
well, Greatness, we appreciate the phone call.
All right. No problem.
Great.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
Hey, Gavalt.
That's funny. I just, about a month ago, one of my acquaintance friends told me, who's a minister, told me to read Joel chapter 3. And he was believing of the same thing. He's a strong supporter of Israel. And you have to read Joel chapter 3. And I've been reading that, and that's funny that he brought that up. The second person
okay.
to say that.
All right, since you've been reading it, Vito, can you explain to me what the heck this guy was saying? I mean, I don't mean to be ignorant, but I'm ignorant.
Well, I understood what he said initially about being dispersed. I think what he was referring to is that.
All over the world.
Well, it goes to what Al was trying to understand, and that was it was the Muslims themselves who sold their people as slaves, and they've dispersed
mm-hmm.
around the world, and they've settled in occupied other areas of the world. So. I'm sure that's what he was referring to when he was talking about that on the Deuteronomy. So
right,
well, I'd like to know who's supposed to take over that part of the world that he referred to as Palestine, since he said that neither of these peoples, the Islams or the Jews, have any right to it, and the ones that are there now are not the ones that were there 5,000 years ago. So I'd love to know who the heck is supposed. Maybe it's supposed to be American territory. I don't know.
Well, wait. We have a question for you from the chat room, Gotti. What does Gotti suggest refer to the area occupied by the so-called Palestinians?
Judea, Samaria, that area.
Yeah, like
or Gaza,
the West Bank.
Yeah. Well, the West Bank is part of Jordan, and Gaza is part of Egypt. It's pretty simple. I mean, if you go
so
back,
you would call
if,
it
if you
northwest Egypt, then.
Well, Gaza is part of Egypt. Gaza was always
right.
part of Egypt until 1967, when Israel
right.
and Egypt had a war. The West Bank was part of Jordan, although that area had been promised to Israel as far back as the Balfour Declaration and by the United Nations. That area was not given to Israel because Israel, at that point in time in 1948, even though they were only given one-tenth of what they were originally promised, they accepted it, even though all the Arab states screamed and yelled and said they didn't, and it became 10 times smaller than what they initially were promised. They said, we'll take it. We just want a small piece of land where we can make our own home. So that land, the West Bank, depending upon what area and time frame you're looking at, was Jordan or Transjordan.
That's right. Transjordan was prior to 1967, right?
Well, Transjordan was actually prior to 48. That whole area was split up by the United Nations, and prior to that, the League of Nations, on paper when they split up the Ottoman Empire. Until that time, there was no Jordan. Until that time, there was no Syria. There was no Lebanon. It was called Transjordan. People need to learn their history. Hey.
Now, what part of Israel now, just to make it clear for our audience, what part of Israel is being talked about to cede to the Palestinians to create this Palestinian land?
Well, that's part of the problem,
East
because
Jerusalem?
Both parts. They refer to it as Gaza, and they refer to it as the West Bank. They're separate. One is down south, up against the border of Egypt. The other is in the east, up against the border of Jordan. This is the biggest problem. It's not even a landlock. There's no way to connect it to unless you put in an overpass highway, which was one of the things proposed when Ehud Barak was prime minister, and he sat down with Yasser Arafat and met 98% of his demands for a Palestinian state and even offered over 70% of East Jerusalem, and Arafat walked away from the table. The solution by Israel at that time was to build a highway that would connect Gaza to the West Bank because they're two separate areas. So
right.
what they're referring to Palestine are two different countries.
But see, that's my question, Gotti. This is what my biggest fear is. They're going to create this land, and they're going to create some Palestinian state, and you have Gaza, and then you have separated by Israel, Israel's land, and then you have the West Bank. Now, I can envision the United Nations then drawing a line, say we can't have the people of Palestine separated, therefore we're going to give them the entire southern part of Israel, starting from the northern point of Gaza to the northern point of the West Bank, going east to west and south to the Egyptian border.
Sure, I can see that happening.
What's that?
Let's just cut Israel in half. I mean, it wasn't enough that they gave back more of their own land in 1978 to make peace with Egypt when they returned the entire Sinai. Now they're gonna give back, you know, just cut it in half and give back all this other land that was originally promised as far back as the Balfour Declaration.
All right, which leads us into on Thursday, Abbas is going to be petitioning the UN for a state of Palestine.
Right.
And this is all happening in a couple of days. So how do you think that's going to go down? Yeah.
Not too well. You know, there's pros and cons to all of this, and I said way back when they first started talking about asking for statehood that the good thing, if there is a good side to this coin, if it happens, then what you have is you have a sovereign nation known as Palestine. What do you think Israel will do the first time Hamas decides to fire a rocket from the Gaza Strip into civilian territory? Now they're a sovereign nation. What do you think is going to happen?
Nothing.
Nothing? How about war?
Nothing.
How about they attacked us? That's a declaration of war. Right now they're just refugees, they're terrorists, they're freedom fighters, and the whole world screams every time Israel does something in retaliation. But once they're a sovereign nation, it's no longer a terrorist organization or a rogue organization operating without a flag, is it? Now they're a sovereign nation attacking another sovereign nation. You watch how it plays out. Because that's when all the gloves will be off, and Benjamin Netanyahu will say, you know what? The gloves are off. You're a sovereign nation now. You want to lob rockets at us? Guess what? It's not going to be the same. I think the Palestinians, the so-called Palestinians, are biting off a lot more than they can chew. Because there's a lot of consequences that could happen if they become a state.
But they're blind hatred for Israel. Go ahead, Al. I'm sorry.
I'm sorry. Go on about their blind hatred for Israel. That's a good point. Go on.
I'm just saying that the blind hatred for Israel and the Jews is what is going to get the Palestinians in trouble and Hamas in trouble, which they deserve every bit of it. Then they deserve for Israel to retaliate once they launch Kedusha rockets and missiles inside Israel and then try to hide behind a church, a school, or a woman.
Exactly. Exactly. It will no longer be that way. It's no longer a terrorist organization. Hamas is a political entity. Like it or not, they were voted in a so-called democratic election to govern the Gaza Strip. If the Gaza Strip becomes part of the same government as Abbas and the Fatah movement in the West Bank, then you've got Palestinian sovereignty. You've got a nation. Israel's not going to care what they call themselves. If they decide to lob rockets into Israel, it's a sovereign nation attacking a sovereign nation. And I guarantee it will be totally different this time around. Netanyahu is waiting for an opportunity like that. This is all bull what's going on right now on paper, whether America will veto it or not, which in itself is a joke, considering the whole reason they're coming to the UN to ask for statehood is because of what President Obama said. They never went that route before. They were still arguing how to sit down at a table together. Now all of a sudden it's, oh, well, we want statehood because Obama had to open his mouth back in 2009 and say, I want to see a Palestinian sovereign nation by September 2011. Obama brought all this on.
He needs a phone bank for his reelection team.
Yeah, he does need a phone bank, doesn't he? He sure as heck had one in the Gaza Strip in the West Bank last election.
Yeah, you know, that's when his handle was told him. We're talking about West Bank. We're not talking about phone bank, you dumbass.
Well, hey, Vito, we got a caller. You want to
All right,
talk
let's put him on. Yeah. There we
All
go.
Right.
Welcome to Radio Jihad. Keep it clean.
Holter always keeps it clean.
Holter, hey. Mama mia, no Sharia.
Hey, guys.
How you doing?
Holter,
how are you?
How are you?
I'm great. I wanted to call in because Gotti just hit on a great point there about that sovereign nation and all that, and I guess I just wanted to expound on that a little bit, and the fact that I've been saying that, pardon me, about Hezbollah ever since Lebanon basically let them into their government up there. I personally think that changes the stakes completely in Lebanon. In other words, if Hezbollah lobs a couple rockets or missiles into Israel, you know, that's no longer this renegade bunch of terrorists that Lebanon can say, well, they did it and we're trying to stop them kind of a thing. It's all on the Lebanese government. So if you're a member of the Lebanese army, you're fair game in my view. And at the same time, I think we've kind of saw, you know, Netanyahu take that stance when, you know, they basically said to Hamas in Gaza, they said, okay, you're the government, you're the ruling government of Gaza now, that's fine, but any rocket that comes into Israel, we don't care if Islamic Jihad sent it off or Al Qaeda sent it off or you know some moron on his own set it off. You're responsible for what comes out of Gaza, and I think that's a good point what he made about the fact that the Palestinians, or whatever you want to call them, is
so-called Palestinians,
the Transjordanians. You know, I mean, obviously that's a great point. I mean, if do they really want that liability?
They don't. People need to go back and look at history. How did these so-called refugee camps in the West Bank even get started? Where did this come from? You have to go back and look at the whole area from pre-1948 to 1969 to see what really happened. Because the so-called Palestinians, I mean, quick history lesson, okay? 1948, Israel gets statehood. It's voted by the UN. They are given the right to have a sovereign nation. Now, what happened? You had Jews there. You had Arabs there. At that time, that area was known as a mandate. It was being run by the British. It was the British mandate until they pulled out and Israel became a sovereign nation. You had both Jews and Muslims living in that area. The Brits didn't even want to do it because there was terrorism and fighting going back and forth between the Arabs and the Israelis, or the Arabs and the Jews, before Israel became a nation. Okay? So 1948 comes along, Israel becomes a state. Now you had Transjordan, you had Egypt, and you had Syria. And they said, well, we're going to wipe this new little country off the map. We are, and I quote, going to make the Mediterranean red with the blood of the Jews. So what we want all the Muslims to do is get out of Israel. Get out of Israel now. And after we pulverize it and kill all the Jews, you can move back in. Well, there was one little flaw with that plan. Those that chose to leave went to Jordan and Egypt, but they didn't win the war. The little country of Israel survived. Then they couldn't move back in because it was a sovereign nation and they had fled. There were many Arabs that stayed behind. A perfect example of that is Abu Ghosh. It's a village outside of Jerusalem where today those Muslim Arabs serve side by side in the Israeli army with the Jews. Why is that? Because they chose to stay under the Israeli flag. They have people in the Israeli parliament, members of parliament. They vote. They have better rights than they would in any Arab country. But getting back to those that fled, they ended up in Jordan, and they ended up in Egypt. They tried to overthrow the governments. That's where the PLO started. Yasser Arafat in Jordan. there was a coup where they tried to overthrow King Hussein. King Hussein cracked down on them. Does anyone remember the term or the group Black September? That name came from a September day when there was massive fighting between the Jordanians and the Palestinians. And King Hussein threw them out of his country. The ones that stayed went to the West Bank to refugee camps, which Jordan started, not Israel. The other ones went to Syria. Guess what Syria did? They kicked them out because they tried to overthrow the government. They went to Lebanon, and that's how the civil war in Lebanon started. Until that time, Lebanon was a Christian nation. This is what people don't understand. These so-called Palestinians have been thrown out of every nation they've been to since it started. Now, doesn't that tell you something? The Jordanians don't want them. The Egyptians don't want them. Why wasn't Gaza given back to Egypt when they made peace with Anwar Sadat and gave back the entire Sinai? Israel said, take it. We don't want it. And Anwar Sadat said, neither do we. And that's where these so-called refugee camps came from. Israel didn't start these refugee camps. Egypt and Jordan did. Now, once again, as we always say on Radio Jihad, don't believe me. Research it. You'll come to the same conclusion because it's a fact.
And that is like the best 10 minutes of BTR in months, right there. Radio Jihad, it's all about educating, right?
That's correct.
Yeah, no, that was awesome. So I'm gonna revise my references because obviously you know I don't give any credence to the land of Palestine. I don't give any credence to the fact that they are Palestinians. But you got to call these people something so people know what you're talking about. So maybe I can just change that to so-called. Just use so-called Palestinians.
Well, I say so-called Palestinians because these people have no home.
Yeah.
Now, if you want to call someone a Palestinian, here's the way you can do that. If they were born in that area known as Palestine before 1948, they're Palestinian, be it Jew or Muslim. But they would have had born there just like anyone born in the United States refers to themselves as an American. When you have people all over the world who are from Kuwait and Iraq and Sudan and Libya and Qatar, and I could go on naming different countries, say, oh, I'm a Palestinian. Really? Did your family ever live in that area? Or are you just claiming that you want a home? Because I've yet to meet one person who told me he was, no, I take that back, I have met one, because he was actually born in the West Bank. But outside of that one individual, in all the years that I've been dealing with this, and I lived in Israel for many, I've met one individual who claimed to be a so-called Palestinian who truly could take his family back to that time where, yes, he did own, his family came from the land that was known as Palestine. But Palestine never had a government. Palestine never had a flag. Palestine never had a governor or a president. This is why I get so ticked when people refer to an area as Palestine. Show me on a map outside of Google today, show me where it says Palestine. There is no such place.
Well, Gandhi, there's something, though, that'll even piss you off even more. The United Nations states that following the 1947 United Nations decision to partition Palestine, so that's a little bit of a mislead.
Right. Well, no, because what they were doing, Vito, and you've got the words there, 1947, it was a territory. It was a territory that was given the name Palestine. And for those that don't know, the name Palestine comes from the word Philistine. You know,
right.
So let's go back into history.
1920, it was named by the British.
Exactly. And why did the Brits get it? Because after World War I and the Ottoman Empire, we're getting back to the whole crux of the whole point. This is where the Muslim Brotherhood rose out of. 1928. Why? Because in 1924, the Caliphate, the Ottoman Empire, the Islamic Empire, which went all the way to the gates of Vienna, throughout all the Middle East, parts of Africa, Italy, China. I mean, look at how huge it was divided up, and that's where the area or territory known as Palestine came from, but it was never a country.
Holger, what's your opinion on that? Oh, I think we
Is
lost
he
him.
Still there? I hope not.
Oh, yeah. No, he's not. Oops. Thanks, Holger, for calling in.
Holger.
Getting Roddy all riled up.
Call back. Yeah, you got me riled up all right. Well, you know, you just hit on something very, very important, Vito. And since I'm obviously on my soapbox, I'll just take a minute longer and explain this
to
people.
No, go ahead.
This is what started the Muslim Brotherhood. This is what people need to understand as far as history is concerned. Because what happened was, after it was split up, you had five guys sitting in Egypt, five Muslims, who said, how could this happen? We are, as Alan noted earlier on in the show, superior to all other human beings. How did the Jews and Christians do this to us? The Muslims are more superior. We're a superior being. We were conquering the world. And they started a group which sole purpose was to reestablish the Islamic Caliphate, and they called it the Muslim Brotherhood. It's not ancient history. People think of World War II as ancient history. This happened in 1928. Wasn't that long ago? That's the start of what people today refer to as radical Islam. No, it's not radical Islam, because only in recent history, 1920s, prior to that you had the Ottoman Empire, the Islamic Caliphate. They were doing the same thing they're doing now. Jihad, Sharia, stealth jihad, conquering areas, building more mosques. Wake up, people. History has not repeated itself. It's continuing. This is what they have done since the inception. And that's why
okay.
I get so angry.
Gotti, this is of importance, and I want you to put this in perspective for our listeners as well. The issue that's going on in Turkey with Erdogan, suddenly he's wanting to resurrect the Islamic Caliphate, and it's totally in contrast to what Ataturk did. What's going to be the impact of Turkey now, and how with the call for an Islamic Caliphate, and how is that going to impact Israel and the rest of the Middle East?
Well, unfortunately, the last sentence that you just gave me, and all I heard was, how will it affect? My phone was breaking up, and I didn't catch your last sentence. Repeat the question.
How is it going to affect Israel with Erdogan calling for the caliphate, you know, which is totally diametrically opposed to what Ataturk did? All of a sudden, Erdogan seems to be going down the fundamentalist route, who's the prime minister
yes.
of Turkey.
Yes, and again,
what's the impact
going to
be on the Middle East, and what's it going
to
be on Israel as well?
We need to look back at recent history, and I hate calling it history because it wasn't that long ago, but anything beyond a minute ago is history. You need to look back at recent history. Turkey was the second Muslim nation to recognize the state of Israel. A lot of people don't know that. They've had diplomatic ties. They've shared military strategy. They've shared military secrets. Israel has sold Turkey weapons. They have been wonderful allies with embassies and consuls in both states, both countries. And what you have now, part of the Arab Spring, this is what we see happening. This is what, and I'm sure you guys talked about it on your show. I've been talking about it since January on my show, which, by the way, you can listen to right here on Radio Jihad Thursday nights from 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern Time on America Akbar. I've been talking about this in all seriousness since January, that what you would see, and I called this. I said this was going to happen. I'm not some wonderful psychic. It was obvious. You've got Turkey wanting to get in good with the OIC, and you've got all of these different so-called democratic
revolutions throughout the Middle East that's known as the Arab Spring, when in reality, if you look at who's behind it, it's nothing more than a Sharia spring. And you're getting your, what others call radical, I don't like using the term, your radical Islamists are going to start running these governments, and Turkey jumping on the bandwagon. And it's unfortunate. It's really, truly unfortunate because, as I said, Israel and Turkey have had wonderful, longstanding relations.
Yeah, and a lot of Israelis vacation in eastern Turkey, I'm sorry, western Turkey, off the Greek Isles. I mean, that's been a haven for Israelis. And now seeing the way Erdogan has gotten and how fundamental he's gotten, that just adds fuel to the fire, considering what's happened in Egypt and how the Gaza Passage now has been opened without any type of what do you call it, customs searching, so to speak. So anything and everything is coming through the Gaza Pass from Egypt into Gaza. So, you know, there's so much instability, but Erdogan is the one that holds the chips. And this guy is resorting back to his fundamental roots.
Right, but he's doing what he feels the rest of the Middle East is screaming for. And this is nothing more than what's been coming. I've been talking about it, like I said, since January, that we would see it come to a head in September. Why all of a sudden did Turkey decide, if we don't get a formal apology from the State of Israel, a formal apology for the Mavi Marmara incident last year, last May, why all of a sudden today, actually last month, did they say we're cutting off all ties? And then they threw the Israeli ambassador to Turkey out of their country and recalled their own ambassador. Why did it wait a whole more than a year and a half for that to come to a head? Was it just coincidence? No. No, it's because we're headed to September. You've got this Arab Spring going on, and they see the time is ripe. As I've said before, the Muslim Brotherhood has been waiting 60 years for this, and they're not going to let it slip by.
Yeah, good point. Al, you've been awfully quiet.
Yeah, I'm just listening to. No, it's good. No, that was a good history of Israel. In fact, when I was up in Dearborn, I did an interview with a woman who is a Palestinian activist named Shireen Himash, and I asked her. I said, "Well, what about the Israeli Arabs and the Muslims that are in the Knesset?" She goes, "Oh, they're a tool of the Israelis to show the world that they are a so-called democratic country." So
oh,
she
really?
Thinks that it's all a conspiracy theory.
Really? And that's Muslims who live inside the borders of Israel have it better than if they lived in any other country. You know, it's amazing how the women in Israel can vote, including Muslims. Oh, isn't that a shocker? You're not going to see that in any other Islamist country. They can drive cars. Oh, isn't that amazing? They're not beaten if they're caught out in the street without a chaperone or a hijab or a burqa. Oh, isn't that amazing? Yeah. The only true democratic country in the entire Middle East is Israel, and we all know that. So much for a tool. She's a tool.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting how it all goes down on Thursday, and it's a very important date that everybody should keep their eye on, because how this plays out is going to have repercussions here for the months and years ahead in a very big way.
Absolutely. And you know, what starts over there, and we've all said it on this show before, in my show, that, you know, people think, you know, it's 6,000 miles away, we don't need to worry about it, it's not going to affect us. Hello? Everything going on right now in this country, everything, from Sharia court in Texas to Fatima Abdullah, who committed suicide by banging her head against a coffee table in Tampa, Florida. All of that falls back on this.
Yeah, when that didn't work, she banged her head on the tiling until she killed herself.
Yeah.
she had a learning disability 52 times, and then she threw herself onto the coffee table.
Exactly.
I'm still not done yet.
It's actually a joke. I mean, nobody would believe this. If you made a movie and tried to pass it off, nobody would believe it. It would be a comedy. I swear, Your Honor, she ran into my fist 100 times. I mean, who's going to believe this stuff?
Well, and then you have, you know, Hillary Clinton, you know, making excuses today and sanitizing the religion of peace. And you have Barack Obama setting the stage in June 4th, 2009. And it seems like since that speech, honestly, Gotti, it does seem like the escalation of Islamic activism has really increased in the United States of America, and to the point where it's becoming quite scary in a sense that speech emboldened Muslims to believe now that they can reign supreme over the United States of America, and they're doing it hiding behind the First Amendment, hiding behind the U.S. Constitution.
Absolutely. But, Vito, do you really blame them when you look at the things that he said to them to a total Muslim audience back in June of 2009? He not only apologized for America, he apologized specifically for America showing its might and being cocky, and I'm paraphrasing, on the Muslim world. He said that he would be the best friend the Muslims had. He talked about making Palestine a sovereign nation. All these things are what they had been waiting to hear, and they saw it, and they ran with it. They knew they had a friend in the White House, and they've used it.
Well, sure, and what people don't understand is it certainly helped advance the Islamic agenda inside the United States because after 2001, after September 11, 2001, certainly George Bush laid the groundwork for Muslims to be accepted when he said that Islam is peace and that, you know, we all can work together. So he accepted Islam. But when Obama got in, he put him on fast track without a doubt. He hid behind his name. His name was not allowed to be used during the Democratic primary nor the presidential race of 2008. Then when he becomes president, he makes sure that Hussein is an essential part of his name. Then we're going over history here, but the June 4th, 2009 Cairo speech, and I've said it before and I'll continue to say it, I think it set the stage for destabilizing the Middle East. When you have the President of the United States who overruns, and he's a guest of Cairo, Egypt. He's a guest of Egypt. He's a guest at Al-Aqsa University. He is a guest of that country, and when he undermines the president of Egypt at that time, Hosni Mubarak, and demands that the Muslim Brotherhood have a seat in his venue while he speaks, that's a dangerous precedent to send, and everything that we're seeing in Egypt now is a result of Obama laying the groundwork and legitimizing the Muslim Brotherhood, who had been outlawed for 30 years there. You know, and prior to that, of course, you have Hassan al-Banna, like you said, in 1928, creating the Muslim Brotherhood. But now we're seeing the influence of the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt. We're seeing it in Libya, most certainly, with the Libyan Muslim Brotherhood. We're seeing it in America with all the Muslim Brotherhood front groups. And Gotti and Al, they're laying on a silver platter the Muslim Brotherhood what their intent is for the Western democracies. We have the explanatory memorandum of 1991, and we have the words of Omar Ahmad. And Omar Ahmad's words can't be any clearer to the United States of America and the American people. Islam is not in America to be equal, but to become dominant. The Quran, the Muslim book of scripture, should be the highest authority in America, and Islam the only accepted religion on earth.
Uh-huh.
That is seditious. That is sedition. That is something that's diametrically opposed to the United States Constitution. Article 6, Section 2 says that the United States law is the supreme law of the land. What Omar Ahmad did was commit sedition, and he should be deported, or actually he should be tried, found guilty, and hung for treason.
Yes.
Hey. Amen. I guess since we follow this so much, what I'm not understanding is how much more can Islam lay on a silver platter to the United States of America, to its citizenry, as to what their plan is for America? When you say that you want your miserable house to crumble from within, and it's in writing, it's written by the Muslim Brotherhood, Abdul Rahman al-Mudi, and then you have Omar Ahmad's words later on, which is the Muslim Brotherhood front group, the Council on American Islamic Relations, and then you look at the Muslim Student Association was the very first organized Muslim Brotherhood group in America in the late 1960s, 67, 68, and now they're in every college and university, and they're providing a scam to in every college and university in the name of diversity, in the name of coexistence. Then you have the Islamic Society of North America, which is a Muslim Brotherhood front group. Then you have the North American Islamic Trust. Nobody's heard of the North American Islamic Trust, but the key to that particular organization is they hold over 80% of the land leases and deeds to the mosques that are built in America.
Right.
And we have well over 2,000 mosques in America. And who is funding the North American Islamic Trust? The Saudi Arabians. So connect the dots. And you don't have to use anybody's forehead to connect them either.
Exactly.
So how do we control that here in the United States? We have to get our politicians to declare the Muslim Brotherhood a foreign terrorist organization, just as Egypt had done before Mubarak was overthrown with the help of the United States and taken over by the Muslim Brotherhood. And once we declare the Muslim Brotherhood a foreign terrorist organization, then all the 30-plus subgroups of the Muslim Brotherhood will be shut down, assets seized, property seized, and that will be the first step in stemming this takeover of the United States of America by winning the hearts and minds of the American people via the Muslim Brotherhood, because there is no difference between the Muslim Brotherhood, Al-Qaeda, and the Taliban other than tactics. As Gadi has said many times before, the ideology is the same. However, the tactics are dramatically different.
Well, Greece likes to point out five different types of jihad.
Was that five different types of jihad?
Yeah. You know, Greece constantly brings that up on my show, and about the fact that, you know, terrorism, which would be jihad of the hand, is five different types of jihad. And the Muslim Brotherhood is definitely using other means, stealth jihad, jihad of the heart, jihad of the mind, jihad of the money. You know, so there's other ways that it can be done. And they all are after the same thing. But they're going about it, like Alan just said, with different techniques.
Right. Yeah, and you know, you would hope that. Go ahead, Al.
No.
See what I thought.
Well, I was just going to say that your quote by Omar Ahmed explains that point using their own words. You don't have to even listen to us.
Exactly.
Well, and Tommy Hunt brings up a good point in the chat room. All you have to do is look at Europe to find out what America is in store for. And, you know, every day you're reading something else about Islam in the United Kingdom and in the rest of Europe. You know, Greece has no money. Greece had to beg, borrow, and steal from the European Union. They were a failed nation. Their country was dead, I mean, financially. They were under financial collapse. So what did the Greek parliament authorize last week? They authorized money to build a mosque, a taxpayer-funded mosque in Athens. Why? Why? You have no money. Why? You know, the United States State Department spending over $700 million to build and fix and repair mosques around the world. $700 million. You know what $700 million can do for Americans right now? Do you know what $700 million can do for Americans that are struggling to pay their mortgage, put gas in their car, put food on the table? And we, Americans, the State Department, is shelling out $700 million to repair and to build mosques around the world. So like you said, Al, so we can win the hearts and minds that we will never, ever win. We are not going to win the hearts and minds of Muslims. End of story. Their ideology is total, is diametrically opposed to man-made law. It is diametrically opposed to the liberties and the freedoms that we have here in the United States, or for that matter, in any Western democracy. But Greece now is spending $150 million or some ungodly amount to build a mosque in Athens, Greece. What the hell is that?
Well, there is a little pushback, and it was a story that we talked about before the show, Vito, about Lloyd's of London, of all places, from unexpected out in left field. Lloyd's of London, according to the story, is filing a lawsuit against Saudi Arabia for 9/11.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was great. A $215 million lawsuit over the 9/11 claims. And they are blaming the Lloyd's of London Syndicate 3500 has filed a lawsuit in federal court in Pennsylvania against Saudi Arabia, several Saudi charitable and financial entities, and prominent Saudi citizens over the September 11, 2001 terrorist attacks. Lloyd says that the Saudi defendants are directly responsible for the attacks and should therefore be responsible for $215 million in claims Lloyd's paid out. I think that's great. Lloyd's of London, they're not too wrong too many times. They're not they hit the nail on the head very, very often.
So now you've got Lloyd's of London. I was just going to say, so now you've got Lloyd's of London going after the charitable organizations that we had mentioned earlier that are funding a financial jihad here in the United States. And now they're going after them. They're going places that the CIA, the FBI, and the NSA have yet to go after. I mean, they have quite well, but not so directly in a court of law, a civil court, where there's discovery. So discovery is going to be a very interesting element in this case.
The 154-page suit filed on September 8th names as defendants, you ready for this? The Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, the Saudi High Commission for Relief of Bosnia and Herzegovina, Saudi Joint Relief Committee for Kosovo and Chechnya, Saudi Red Crescent Society, the National Commercial Bank, Al Raji Banking and Investment Company. Also included as defendants are three Saudi individuals tied to those entities. Prince Salman bin Abdul Aziz Al Saud, Suleiman Abdel Aziz Al Saud, and Yassin Al Qadi. The lawsuit was filed at U.S. District Court for the Western District of Pennsylvania. Each of the defendants named herein was as knowing and material participant in al-Qaeda's conspiracy to wage jihad against the United States, its nationals, and allies, according to the lawsuit. The insurer, Lloyd's of London, charges that these Saudi defendants knowingly provided material support and resources to al-Qaeda in the years leading up to 9/11. The complaint claims that without Saudi Arabia's assistance, al-Qaeda would not have been able to carry out the September 11th attacks. Absent the sponsorship of al-Qaeda's material sponsors and supporters, including the defendants named herein, al-Qaeda would not have possessed the capacity to conceive, plan, and execute the September 11th attacks in the States. The conspiracy among the defendants to wage jihad against the United States, its nationals and allies, including the provisions of material support and resources to defend Al-Qaeda and affiliated terrorist organizations, persons, and entities. That was my weak attempt.
Are you breaking into a British accent there, Vito?
I did. I felt it. You know, I was getting in form there, Gotti.
Oh, okay. I'm just wondering.
It sounded more eloquent that way.
Well, you know, this is first of these lawsuits, and this one's actually 8 years after the last one, because there was a lawsuit filed by a law firm in the United States, and that law firm was Cozen O'Connor. Now, they brought a suit in 2003 on behalf of nearly three dozen insurance companies, including Chubb, Ace, and Allstate, that all alleged that the funding for the 9/11 attacks, in which nearly 3,000 Americans, came directly from Islamic charities that acquired the money through Zakat donations through Islamic banks. And there were many, many banks named in that suit, including the Dubai Islamic Bank. But what's moreover, and this is, again, you never heard about it on regular mainstream media, talk about HSBC, Goldman Sachs, Prudential, AIG, Citibank, USB. They're all named in this lawsuit because they're all Sharia financially compliant. This goes back to 2003. What do we need to see before people wake up?
Well, I think the Lloyds probably has the correct mentality, because these syndicates, you know, they all take a portion of these losses, and now that they've settled upon with Larry Silverstein,
mm-hmm.
Up in New York for the World Trade Center, obviously the syndicates want to get their money back. So this is beautiful.
So did Allstate and Ace and Chubb. It's the exact same thing, going about it in a different way. But the point is a lot of these lawsuits that we're not hearing about are targeting not only like Lloyd's of London, who's targeting Saudi Arabia specifically, and obviously has the paperwork or the paper trail or investigation to prove it, but the lawsuit that was filed back in 2003 in the United States had a paper trail directly that the Zakat donations, which we've all talked about Sharia law and Sharia compliant finance, which everybody's thinking in this country deals with one or another one of these banks, they sued these banks on the grounds that that money was here in America. Money that when you do business with an American bank, part of that is going to Zakat, and that is what helped finance Al-Qaeda and the 9/11 attacks.
Correct.
So basically, Americans financed it themselves.
Well, they named the Al-Raji Banking and Investment Company, and Al-Raji is ranked as the fourth largest Sharia-compliant financial institution in the world and the largest in Saudi Arabia. Its controlling shareholders are believed to be the wealthiest non-royal citizens of Saudi Arabia. The Al-Raji family, ominously, the Al-Rajis are also considered to be among Saudi Arabia's most active philanthropists. Maybe they can pay off our national debt. Al-Raji prides itself on ethical practices.
Yeah.
It specifically prohibits transactions which involve businesses such as alcoholic drinks, narcotics trafficking, tobacco, or interest taking companies such as non-Islamic banks, insurance companies, and gambling houses. Now,
yeah, don't tell that to Al-Qaeda or the Taliban because of the heroin that comes out of Afghanistan, but I'm just saying.
I was going to say, I guess, now, is that where the Taliban employees park their 401ks in these Islamic Sharia-compliant 401ks?
Exactly.
Now, they can wipe their asses with their left hand, not using toilet paper, but they can't have an alcoholic drink because it's considered unclean. That's just incredible.
Well, it's interesting you mentioned Suleiman Abdul Aziz Al-Raji because he was from the SAR Foundation, the S-A-A-R Foundation, which achieved prominence as the key subject of that March 20th, 2002 raid by federal agents as part of Operation Green Quest. Now, as part of the Operation Green Quest on March 20th, 2002, federal agents raided 14 interlocking business entities in Herndon, Virginia, associated with the SAR Foundation, looking for ties to the Altaqua Bank and the Muslim Brotherhood. And the raids led to convictions of two people, including your friend, Abdurrahim al-Amoudi, who you mentioned earlier, who worked for Salman Abdul Aziz al-Raji, the SAR Foundation. Al-Moudi admitted that he plotted with Libya to assassinate the Saudi ruler and was sentenced to 23 years in jail. Now, sadly, this whole Operation Green Quest was disbanded. Now, this is one of the largest charity operations by our U.S. government involving the FBI, the Secret Service, ATF, and four or five other names of different Department of Justice. Well, anyway, as a result of conflicts between the FBI and the Bureau of Immigration and Customs Enforcement, in May 2003, the Attorney General and the Secretary of Homeland Security signed an agreement concerning terrorist financing investigations. And due to the infighting between the FBI and these other organizations, this Operation Green Quest was disbanded. So this filing, this lawsuit by Lloyd's of London is actually, from what it sounds like, is continuing where the FBI and the other state organizations folded this operation. So it's taking a private entity to go ahead and do and continue where the FBI, just by their arrogance, destroyed a fantastic operation.
Well, Lloyd's of London, you know, they are brilliant individuals. I can remember last year over dinner speaking to some members of Lloyd's of London, and I asked them what the biggest calamity they were worried about. Was it the hurricanes in Florida, fires? And they looked at me, and each and every one of them agreed that it was earthquakes that they were most concerned about. And not only in the United States, but around the world, but they're also worried about the one in the United States, specifically the fault line that goes up Tennessee and I guess up through to the mid-Atlantic. And boy, were they right. They were absolutely correct. I mean, take the Japanese one, and you have the one in Chile. You've had two in Chile, and then you had a couple in the United States. Most recently, it didn't do much damage, but you still had one that went through Washington, D.C. and up to New York. And then there was another one, was it a 6.5 that hit, was it Tahiti or the Fiji Islands, I think it was last week. So, I mean, these guys know what they're talking about. You know, and any given day, they know where every trade ship is on waters around the world. So they have a reason for doing this, and it's finally you know what's nice is somebody had the balls to implicate Saudi Arabia in this, because it was 19 Muslim men, and most of them were of Saudi origin, who flew planes into the World Trade Center, who flew planes into the Pentagon, and were taken down in Shanksville, Pennsylvania. But nobody wants to admit it. Nobody, you know, everybody wants to sanitize what Islam's intent is for the Western democracies and who was behind the planned attacks. Yes, we know it was Osama bin Laden, but he also had help. And it was, you're talking about, what was it, 15 Saudi nationals, 16 Saudi nationals out of the 19? You know, what else are they engaged in? Well,
they're winning the hearts and minds of the American people with all the money that they are sending over here for the 80% of the mosques whose title holders are this North American Islamic Trust.
Exactly. Now, you know, and that's the other thing. We've connected the dots before, but when you start connecting the dots, you start realizing who is behind the actions that are happening in the United States? Who's behind the changes in the education books in America? You have the Islamic Saudi Academy that's a stone's throw from Washington, D.C. You have the Dar al-Hijra Mosque, which is a stone's throw from Washington, D.C. They're all intertwined. Then you look at the North American Islamic Trust that is buying up and providing money for mosques in America. In 2001, there was 1,200 mosques in America. Today, there's well over 2,000 mosques in America. And who's behind that?
Well, we know the Saudis are. And people ask me, and you give them all this information, they go, well, whew, that's a lot of information. My head's about to explode. But what does it mean? What do these guys really want? And what I tell them is what they want is they want family Sharia courts here in the United States to start, and how they will sell it is they will tell the American public that as Muslims, we have special cultural sensitivities that your court system at the family level is not set up to adjudicate. So all we ask is that you allow us to set up family courts so we can do business problems, and then get all of these other court cases out of the American court, criminal cases, federal cases, et cetera. You don't need to worry about that. We're not going to be any threat to that. We just want you to accommodate us with a family Sharia court that is legally binding here in the United States. What that is going to do, of which there's already been 50 cases within the United States, is going to weaken our judiciary at the foundation by having a competing legal system that is recognized by the government. And that's what you're going to see.
Well, the president actually set that precedent already. I mean, he's already weakened the Constitution in many ways. And the latest, of course, has been with throw Obamacare out, put that aside right now. Don't throw it out because it is an essential part of violating the U.S. Constitution. But the Libyan effort, you know, here's a guy that is full of words. Not only is he full of crap, but he's full of words. And what he likes to do is he likes to talk. And he likes to make promises and then break those promises. He likes to lie. And he knows that he's not going to be held accountable for those lies, for the misinformation, for misleading the American people. And he violates his own statute of the Presidency of the United States, Article 2, Section 2.2 of the U.S. Constitution. He was supposed to bring forth this measure to the United States Congress and have the Senate sign off on this. That's what the U.S. Constitution calls for. But he gives some lame-ass excuse, and anybody and everybody is buying it, including the Republicans who are complicit in this. Because if Lindsey Graham, I like what, as Ann Barnard calls him, the horse's ass from South Carolina, if Lindsey Graham was really this great jurist, was really a jag, he would have brought the president up on charges of violating the U.S. Constitution just on the Libyan effort, because the U.S. Constitution calls for the president to make his case before the United States Congress and for two-thirds of the Senate to sign off on the treaty to mandate our troops to go to war. And he did not. His excuse was, I've taken this to the American people. And then in that same speech, he said, we're talking about days in Libya, ladies and gentlemen. My fellow Americans, we're not talking about weeks or months. We're talking about days. Well, we're at 197 days. So I guess he's right in that regard because he omits the weeks and the months that are associated with the 197 days. Over 6 months. And then he cedes control of the U.S. military to the United Nations. This man is an absolute abhorrent individual. He is certainly anti-American. He is anti-free enterprise and anti-capitalist. Gotti, thanks for joining us tonight. You can listen to Gotti Edelman every Thursday evening from 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time to 10 p.m. on the Radio GI Network right here at Blog Talk Radio. It's called America Akbar. Gotti is also a contributor to the Family Security Matters, and he writes an article every Monday, so follow that. Alan, always a pleasure, man. I want to thank everybody in the chat room. Freedom Wings, listen to Diane. She's on Tuesday, Thursdays, and Saturdays. Great show last Saturday, by the way. All of our guests, Holger, he's on in, I think, Saturday evenings at midnight. Morty, Poppy, thank you very much. Tommy Hunt, glad you're back, babe. Iggy Mom, always a pleasure. Beer Hunter and Ian Dore, nice to see you guys. Alan and I will be back tomorrow from 6 p.m. to 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on the Radio Jihad Network. God bless our troops and God bless America. Radio Jihad, striving to educate America. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. I don't have a board. All I got is a chat room. My computer went.
Shoot. Oh, I didn't know.
That's all right. I heard that's why I got the cue that it was 60 seconds. I mean, yeah, then that's why.
I just logged on to my Facebook, and I see a post that I'm going to be on a radio show tonight. This is interesting.
Are you? Where are you going to be?
Evidently, I'm going to be on the Bella D'Angelo show with a Rabbi Nachum Schifrin.
Oh, okay.
What do you say?
Rabbi's one of our guys.
It starts in a half hour, so I guess it's good that I looked at my page to see that I was. That's
the
pretty funny.
You find
7
out,
p.m.
Right?
Central, that's 8 p.m. East Coast, right?
Who, Rabbi? Yeah, Rabbi's out in California.
No, but it says it's going to be at 7 p.m. Central time.
That's 8 p.m. Eastern.
Yeah, so I've got a half hour. Oh, boy.
Oy vey.
Oy vey is right.
Yeah, I think Claire Lopez is going to be on his show tonight. He's a good guy, Rabbi. He's a crazy rabbi. You'll like him.
Well, he's actually a guest with me on this Bella D'Angelo show.
Oh, okay. Congrats.
Well, it's not his show.
Oh, okay. Well, be sure to plug the RJN network.
He's running for Congress out in California.
He's the surfing rabbi.
Yeah. I
oh, no
him.
Kidding.
He's a Facebook friend of mine. Yeah, he's a nut surfer. He runs a kosher surfing camp. I'm serious,
really?
Man. This guy's a trip.
Hey, dude, would you want some matzo balls with that? Oi.
Exactly. Wax that surfboard with some matzo balls.
That's pretty cool, man. That's really cool. I was having a chip, sorry. Yeah, well, good luck on the show. And I know we kind of got into that Saudi Arabian thing. Holy crap. I got to respect Lloyd's of London. At least, you know, they probably took their time in this whole issue, whole ordeal, and getting their ducks in a row and finally taking action, and rightly so.
And they're hitting the charities, which is that's their weak link.
Yeah.
That's their funding. Yeah. That's their funding vehicle are all these charities.
Well, Al, you've said it in the past. You've called it. I mean, with all these charities, I mean, you know, it's really good to see because that's where they hide behind.
Mm-hmm. And Gotti brings it up, the five kinds of jihad. Money jihad is one of them. If you can't fight a jihad with your person, then you fight jihad with your money, and you're obligated to do it. Every Muslim is obligated.
You know, that's funny you say that because now it makes it clearer why Obama said what he said during that June 4th speech in changing the tax laws in America to allow Muslims to give to zakat. So that's just another form that Obama wants to allow Muslims to continue to give to these types of charities, right?
Yeah. Yeah, he's making it kosher.
Yeah.
No pun intended. We need to get him out of office so bad.
Yeah, he's really destroying this nation. And he, you know, 4 years, he would have succeeded in dividing and conquering. He succeeded with the rhetoric, the inflammatory rhetoric. He talks about wanting to build bridges. In the meantime, he demonizes the GOP and conservatives. And basically, he lies in order for his minions to carry a message around. You know, he can't run on his record of jobs. He doesn't take responsibility for his failed domestic policies. So now the best thing to do is to blame the Republicans, and that resonates with his base, especially the Black Americans.
Yeah.
You know, because they're repeating that mantra that it's all the Republicans' fault, when in fact, even when he had a majority, a supermajority in Congress, he couldn't get anything done. Even the Senate in March summarily rejected his budget 97-0. And that was a bipartisan vote.
Mm-hmm. You don't hear that except for here.
No, but Al, isn't that a divide and conquer? You divide America, and then you conquer it, and all you have to do is continue to give misinformation and lie to the American people, and just make sure you appease your base. And when you tell enough lies, your base is going to follow you no matter what, and you create this atmosphere of fear and terror, much like Muslims do, and you basically go on your way to change things. Divide and conquer.
Yeah.
He'll divide the nation, he'll conquer, and he'll do away with the U.S. Constitution.
Yeah, and the president's job is to bring the country together, not divide.
Yeah.
Oy vey. Yeah, exactly. Holy cannoli.
Holy. All right. Well, have a good evening.
All right, you gentlemen. Too. Good show.
Yeah, likewise. We'll see. We'll talk to you in the morning or tomorrow.
All right. Okay. Have a good one.
Ciao.
Okay. Bye.